Hi, everybody. Today is Thursday, July 17th, 2025, and our friend Alex Craner is back with us. Welcome back, Alex.
Thank you for having me, Nima, and greetings to all your viewers and listeners from Croatia.
Alex, the situation in the West Asia, in Syria, is getting much worse. And here is what Rubio said about the situation while Donald Trump was talking with one of the Arab officials, Bahraini officials. Here is what Rubio said about
it. Obviously, these are historic, long-time rivalries between different groups in the south west of Syria, Bedouins, the Druze community, and it led to an unfortunate situation and a misunderstanding, it looks like, between the Israeli side and the Syrian side. So we've been engaged with them all morning long and all night long with both sides, and we think we're on our way towards a real de-escalation and then hopefully get back on track in helping Syria build a country and arriving at a situation there in the Middle East is far more stable. So in the next few hours, we hope to see some real progress to end what you've been seeing over the last couple hours.
Yeah, the problem, Alex, with Syria, as Bashar Assad said in one of his interviews that just I've just watched it. It's from the past, but he said the problem with Libya was not Gaddafi; it was Libya itself. For the case of Iraq, was the identity of Iraq, and the case of Syria, it seems to be the same, that Israel doesn't want a Syria, a united Syria. On the other hand, you have these Al-Qaeda and jihadists in Syria. They have total excuse to go and bomb Syria. What's going on when you look at Syria today and the way that Israelis are attacking Syria? We know that the government in Syria tried to do everything to appease the government, the Netanyahu administration. But after all, they're not satisfied. Your take on what's going on there?
Well, very unfortunately, we might be looking at a greater military escalation in Syria, which could engulf the whole region, which is, it favors the side that prefers chaos, you know, and the strategy of chaos has for the long time been the preferred method of foreign policy by the Western Empire. And here I would, you know, the chief culprits with long historical tradition of doing this would be former European colonial powers, Great Britain and France. And they essentially created the mess that is now festering still and erupting into a greater conflict, and that is the Sykes-Picot agreement from 1916, which created arbitrary divisions across the Arab world that cut across, you know, tribal sectarian territories almost deliberately so that they could keep them disunited, that they could continue to pit them one against the other and to dominate them in this way, because, you know, it's the simple approach of divide and rule. And it seems to me that they're still doing this. And of course, then in 1917, we had the Balfour Declaration and the beginning of the formation of Israel, which again completely comes from out of London. The preparation started already in the late 19th century. Then we had the Balfour Declaration, and in 1948, the creation of Israel. Israel's sole purpose there is to be the beachhead, to keep the region destabilized, and to use it in order to maintain Western hegemony in the region. You know, if you keep parties at war nonstop, and you're the one with the monopoly on financial capital and on credit, you have the global monopoly on advanced high-tech weaponry and other types of technology, you know, for communications, for oil drilling, pipelines, you know, all the technologies that are necessary for industrial development and production of energy and transport and so on. Well, then, you know, if you keep everybody at war against the other, you keep them from developing, but you also make them dependent on you for money, because once you go to war, first thing you need is going to be credit. And then immediately you're going to have to spend a lot of that credit, if not all of it, on weaponry, which again, you're going to be buying from BAE Systems and so forth, which are one of the major arms merchant in the Middle East. So this is divide and conquer, constant flaming of the war escalations is coming ultimately from London and then also from Paris. And we still have there, military and naval presence of French ships, American ships, British ships. But the difference now is that Trump is trying to extricate the United States from that region. And I know that it doesn't seem that way, because a lot of people are interpreting Trump's action quite as the opposite. But I'm, the more I'm observing events and politics in the United States itself, the more I'm convinced that Trump is actually trying to extricate the United States from these imperial misadventures. I don't think that he's a very sincere friend of Benjamin Netanyahu or a sincere ally of the state of Israel. And I think that he's genuinely looking to partner up with nations like Iran, Russia, China, and others. And Israel is, in fact, the only reason why this is the only obstacle in the way of all that. And it's a very costly obstacle because, you know, the United States doesn't really have a whole lot of upside from supporting Israel, but it has a huge amount of downside. You know, it's keeping it at war. It's keeping it constantly at a risk of being dragged into a quagmire, particularly against Iran. And that would be a quagmire that the United States has no chance of winning. So it's a, you know, very, very little to gain, maybe not even that, maybe nothing to gain, with the potential of a catastrophic, a cataclysmic disaster happening to the United States on account of Israel. I think that the logic of all this is so obvious and so straightforward that the only thing that's keeping the United States from completely shifting their alliance there, their allegiances, is this very strong, very powerful political bloc, which are the Zionist Jews in the United States, and the evangelical Christians, which are, for very strange and irrational reasons, completely and fanatically devoted to the state of Israel. They believe that somehow it's biblical, it's prophetic, it's the Armageddon, it's going to be the second coming of Christ, it's going to be the coming of Messiah. The Israelis, a good segment of the Israeli Jews who are, let's say, religious enough to even consider these things, they think that there's going to be a big battle of Armageddon, and that only after, Israel has been practically destroyed and punished by practically the whole world, will there be the coming of the Messiah that's been promised to them since the biblical time? So, you know, what people think and what they believe, we're delving into extremely, extremely strange things. But when you clear out the analysis to just, pros and cons, the gains and losses that, the United States can obtain in different ways of relating to Israel, to Iran, to Syria, to Turkey, to Saudi Arabia, and so on. Israel is a major problem for the United States. And I very much doubt that this is not patently obvious to Donald Trump.
But Do you feel that he's somehow dealing with Netanyahu, is somehow trying to appease Netanyahu, or his administration tries to appease Netanyahu? From what we've seen so far, how did you find the relationship between the two administrations?
It's very hard to judge from what we know, but I see that the relationship is not. It doesn't seem to me friendly on Trump's side. It doesn't seem friendly from Netanyahu's side either. Netanyahu is desperate. He absolutely needs the American support, because no American support, it means the end of Israel very quickly, right? And so he desperately needs the American support, and he's maneuvering to make sure that he doesn't lose that support. On the other hand, Trump cannot show himself to be hostile to Israel, even though, you know, from Trump, we had different signals. Remember when Jeffrey Sachs a few months ago had a video on X where he said that Benjamin Netanyahu is a deep, dark son of a bitch, and then more, you know, and then Trump reposted this in one of his posts. And we saw that when Trump went and made a tour of the Middle East, he skipped Israel. He didn't go there. And he has expressed sharp criticism of Israel for their bombing of Iran, which is kind of unique in American political life, because normally everybody has a knee-jerk reaction. Whatever Israel does, Israel has the right to defend herself. That's the only thing you're ever going to hear. So the fact that Trump was saying that he's not very, very happy with them, and then when people were trying to suggest that, well, it's actually Iran's fault, and he said, yeah, but I'm actually, he was actually putting the weight of his criticism on Israel. And then we also know that Benjamin Netanyahu went to the United States for, I don't know if he's still there, but he's been there for a few days, and they had many, many meetings, and some of these meetings didn't go well. And we know that at least on one occasion, Donald Trump stormed out of the meeting with Netanyahu. There was no joint press conference after that. So we don't know what happened, but it doesn't seem that the relationship is easy. And it, from everything I gather, it seems to me that Trump is very serious about getting both Iran and Israel to stand down and to stop attacking one another. It seems to me that he's really keen on making sure that the relationship, that the region stays at peace. This we've known for the last month, since the 12-day war ended. But we've also, on one of our previous podcasts, we've talked about Syria, that, you know, it will be relatively easy, and I mentioned the British hand in Syria, that it will be relatively easy for the British to get something going in Syria, to use Syria to again cause an arson attack against peace in the region. And now I think we see that. And, you know, as Kemi Badenoch gave away in one of her recent interviews in Britain, she said that Israel is fighting a proxy war on the behalf of the United Kingdom, and the United Kingdom does not have interest in there being peace in the region. Their interest is to keep the region destabilized and to eventually bring about the regime change in Iran. Trump said explicitly that he's not looking to do a regime change in Iran. The British are saying that they want a regime change in Iran. We saw just this week a statement from Lord, what is his name? I have to look it up. Lord Beamish, who went and gave a whole statement about why Iran is a great threat to the British, to Great Britain, to the British people, and to British interests. And so it's, you know, it's it's always that side that is stirring the pot in the Middle East, as they do elsewhere, as they do in the Ukraine, as they do, as they're preparing to do in the Balkans. And I think that Trump is actually trying to do something completely different.
I want to talk about Iran, but before getting to Iran and the case of Iran, we have a country which, in my opinion, is so important, but you see little coming out of just, they're doing nothing but making chaos. It's called Turkey.
Azerbaijan?
No, I'm talking about Turkey. And they're in Syria. They're trying to do something in the northern part of Lebanon. And do you feel that, because many people are arguing that Erdogan is somehow pursuing a new empire, an Ottoman Empire, and all of these things. But after all, do you see anything good coming out of these moves, political moves on the part of the government in Turkey, in the way that they're involved in Syria? They're trying to do nothing, considering what's going on in Gaza, but just lip service and just talking about the situation. And you see the case of Azerbaijan, as you've mentioned. How do you see the role of Turkey in whole calculation?
Well, it seems to me that Turkey, particularly Erdogan and the Turkish deep state and intelligence apparatus, is on board with the British foreign policy, contributing to the destabilization of the region. And so we know now that the Turks have collaborated with the British MI6 and the British foreign policy establishment in cultivating the Al-Nusra Front. They created together the HDS militia, and they cultivated Al-Jolani and Al-Shibani and a whole bunch of these jihadis. They kind of rebranded them as reformers, as a new democratic front in Syria and so forth. And they have presented them to the world as such. We know that the Turks have been handling the HTS from the, strategic military aspect, but the public relations side has been handled by the British. Now, how does this come about? Well, there's a part of the political class in Turkey which see in all this an opportunity to reestablish some form of an Ottoman Empire, right? And many of them, believe that Aleppo and parts of Syria and Lebanon actually should belong to Turkey. It should be rightfully a Turkish territory. And so this ambition has been exploited by the British to kind of co-opt Turkey into their orbit, into their geopolitical concept. And, the current head of the MI6, Sir Richard Moore, has been one of the main proponents of this concept of Great Turania, right? The Great Turania would be some kind of a political union of the Turkic people across the Central Asia, because you have these Turkic peoples that it goes from Turkey across to Azerbaijan, and then you have Turkmenistan and Kazakhstan, Tajikistan, Uzbekistan, all the way to China. These are all Turkic people, right? And they share a common language and a common culture and so forth. And so, for Erdogan, as his political legacy, it would be appealing to emerge as a great uniter of the Turkic people and creating, this, if this entity stretches across the bulk of the Eurasian continent, that's a very, very powerful position to be in, because, this is where China's One Belt, One Road initiative has many of its transport routes that are extremely important for China's strategic plans and the Russians and, you know, the international north-south transport corridor, which goes from the Indian Ocean all the way to the Baltic Sea, that one would cut across this greater Turania, you know. So it's a very good way for the British, for the Western Empire, to derail Chinese and Russian and BRICS, you know, the whole BRICS approach to the international development. And Iran is absolutely the central pivot point in that whole a concept. And so to try to cater to these ambitions of Turkic leaders like Erdogan and Aliyev in Azerbaijan is a way to, you know, bribe them into coming to your side. And say they, and then they say, like, hey, you know, you could make all this happen, but we have to, you know, we have to sabotage the Chinese-Russian project. We have to derail their development objectives, and then we'll, you know, create this greater Turania, and you're gonna be the big sultans and rulers of this massive, you know, very wealthy political entity. And so this is very, very typical British. They always make promises, and they always try to appeal on to their you know, target proxies by, you know, giving them something that they might be secretly dreaming about. And they say, like, hey, we'll make it happen. We'll help you make this happen. And you're going to help us by, you know, regime changing Iran, by weakening Russia, by supporting Ukraine, by derailing this north-south, by partitioning Iran, maybe, you know, breaking off Tehran from the Caspian coast and so on. So this is where this is all coming from, Nima. But, you know, I have this is clear enough, but I have a suspicion that this is not a particularly strong card to play. Because if it were a strong card, they wouldn't wait for the moment of absolute desperation to play that card. Because the derailing of the Eurasian integrations and Russia and the Belt and Road Initiative was supposed to happen by imposing a proxy war through Ukraine on Russia. Well, you know, they lost that one. And so now the British have signed a military cooperation agreement with Azerbaijan. They sent recently a military attaché to Baku for the first time ever. And then I think it was last month or in May, they signed a military cooperation agreement with Kazakhstan. Why does Kazakhstan need to have a military cooperation agreement with the British? I don't understand, but I know why British might like to, you know, start to developing their intelligence network among the security services of Kazakhstan, because, you know, they're going to be running out of the last Ukrainian. So better think about the next beachhead, you know, to start to impose war and destabilization efforts against Russia. So anyway, you know, this is where it comes from. These are the vestiges of the British imperial system. London is still very much keen on perpetuating all that, and so activating their networks in Turkey, HTS, you know, taking over Damascus. Vanessa Billy, who is now in Lebanon, but she used to be a correspondent from Damascus, she said that every four-star hotel in Damascus is packed with British agents, with, you know, whether it be NGOs or private contractors or flat out foreign office personnel, but British are crawling all over Damascus now. And well, you know, the good news is that the Russians understand what the game is. The Iranians understand what the game is. In a very strange turn of event, the Iranians, after yesterday's bombardment of Damascus by the Israelis, the Iranians reached out to Al-Jalani and offered cooperation, which is very, very interesting. again, an indication they absolutely understand what the game is and who the real enemy is. And the Chinese understand the game. And I also more and more strongly believe that Trump understands what the game is and that he's on the right side of history, because somebody who is in the know, it was Susan Coquindo, the Promethean Action Committee, who is very politically active, but she told me that in a recent cabinet meeting about all these Middle Eastern events in Washington, that Trump on several occasions during the meeting made a point of calling America's enemies, you know, Iran, Russia, China. He said, our so-called enemies, and he also called them the people that are perceived to be our enemies. That's a very strange way to formulate, you know, what you mean to say, but it's very clear that he's not buying that Iran is an enemy to the United States, that Russia is an enemy to the United States, that China is an enemy. He understands who the real enemy is. And so that's all bad news for the undead British Empire, because now they have very powerful constellation of regional powers arrayed against them, and they know what the game is. And the British, you know, the whole British thing depends on people with very thin hold on power, you know, like, you know, UAE is important as a new, let's say, new Middle Eastern financial center. Qatar is important as a new, let's call it, intelligence, special forces headquarters for the Western Empire. Damascus is now important, but what? Damascus is ruled by a foreigner imposed by the Turks and the British. That's not going to go very far. Israel is important, but Israel is in its dying agony. And then, you know, like they have a government in Lebanon that doesn't really have the support of the people. And Hezbollah is still strong, refuses to disarm, and does have the support of the people. So I think that all of this stuff that the, you know, this little cabal in London is doing with the ruling families of UAE and Qatar and the deep state of Turkey and these jihadis in Damascus, I don't think that will actually be sustainable for the long term. And I think that ultimately they will fail.
Alex, how do you see the role of British in the Arab states, especially in Qatar? And do you feel they're playing the same?
Oh yeah, absolutely. Oh, well, the British have been have a very, very close cooperation with Qatar. Again, you know, a military alliance. The Qataris are, I think they're the only country in the world that actually shares military bases with the British on the British mainland. And they have two military bases in England where they train their pilots. So the Qatari military pilots are being trained in the United Kingdom. And they have a very, very close intelligence cooperation with the Qataris. The Qatari intelligence agencies with the British intelligence agencies, and they coordinate foreign policy together. Let's remember that when the October 7, 2023 attack in Israel happened, it was kind of coordinated with the Hamas leadership, which is also being coddled in luxury in Qatar, right? These are a handful of Hamas leaders who enjoy a life of luxury in Qatar, fly around on private jets, absolutely do not share the agony of the Gaza people. And they were, I think that they were instrumental in orchestrating the October 7 attacks in Israel. And they were, you know, this was done obviously not by Hamas leaderships that one day decided, hey, let's do this. It was, I think, coordinated with the Israeli and British involvement. And I think that you know, if you know what happened and how it happened, it's absolutely clear that October 7 was a false flag attack, that it was orchestrated to happen that way, that its purpose was to result in a large number of civilian casualties in order to galvanize the Israeli society for the ethnic cleansing of Gaza and also the West Bank. And this is what we have today. It didn't happen randomly. It was done to happen that way. And then we also have to always remember that one of the people who has been deeply involved in all things Middle East, because the British imperative is to not only defend their hegemony in the region, but to bring it to the level they had during their colonial days, you know, of the 19th century, before World War One. And so one of the key linchpins of all of this has been Tony Blair, back in the shadows. He's not in the news. He's not out making statements about, you know, Al Jolani, about Iran, but you can see that he's involved. And his former chief of staff, Jonathan Powell, is deeply involved in networking with the jihadi groups that have now overtaken Syria, and also rebranding them so that you know, to the Western public, they seem very reasonable. If you go to to Davos meet this year in 2025, Tony Blair actually interviewed Assad al-Shibani, the current foreign minister of Syria. He interviewed him in Davos at the World Economic Forum, and al-Shibani gave all these answers that you thought, like, oh, well, this is a really nice young man, such reasonable answers. I mean, they want democracy. They want to empower women. I swear, this was part of the discussion. They want freedom and prosperity for the Syrian people and peace and stability in the region. I mean, who wouldn't want to take this guy home and introduce him to his daughters, right? Wonderful, just wonderful. But what you saw actually is exactly this public relations stunt, so that everybody thinks, like, oh, now we're rid of that evil Bashar al-Assad and these really nice people are there. And look, Tony Blair is interviewing him, and we can all see how really nice he is. Well, that's part of the whole mix, you know, because probably the most important audience for all this is actually the Western public. Because, you know, we are the ones that have to acquiesce, that we have to consent to the new redrawing of the Middle Eastern map, and to regime change Iran, and to bring the Shah, which the British and the Israelis have been coddling and cultivating as the next leader. And so, you know, Qatar in this whole equation is the important, how do you call it, kind of like intelligence, diplomacy, special forces headquarters for the region. But, you know, the problem is that Qatar is a little nothing. It can be wiped out easily. And they're a terrible irritant to the Iranians, and they're a terrible irritant to the Saudis themselves. Like, the Saudis hate the Qataris. And, you know, they're not taking action now, but, you know, it could easily happen that the circumstances in the region say that, you know, Mohammed bin Salman and the Iranian leadership say, okay, let's clean this up. And then there's no more Qatar very easily. You know, who's going to defend them? Nobody's going to be able to defend them.
Alex, when it comes to Iran and Russia and China, recently we had the foreign minister of China talking about how they're trying to help Iran to defend Iran's dignity and Iran's sovereignty, and all of these sort of talks that are happening behind the scene, I would argue, between Iran, Russia, and China in the aftermath of the attack on Iran. I think that a lot happening behind the scene that we are not aware of, in terms of the Iranian defense system, how they're trying to rebuild the Iranian defense system, reconstruct that, and make a better position for Iran if any sort of attack happens in the near future. How do you feel the way that Russia and China are behaving in the aftermath of the attack on Iran? We had, on the other hand, we had the Israeli sources. I don't know if you saw the article in Axios talking about behind the scene, Putin is trying to convince Iranian for zero enrichment. Iranians are not happy with the support they received from Russia during the war with Israel. They're trying to smear everything between Iran and Russia, draw a line between the two nations. But all the sources that they're talking about in Israel or in Europe, it's so interesting.
Yeah. I suspect that these are all psyops because they are, you know, they're desperate to derail the relations between Russia and Iran. And they're also very desperate to derail the relations between Russia and the United States, you know, because they want to isolate everybody and they want everybody to only talk to them. But we know that I think that just yesterday or the day before, Anthony Blinken, of all people, gave an interview to one of your compatriots. Christiane Amanpour, the valiant CNN journalist. And Anthony Blinken made a few very, very stunning revelations there, in which he said that actually the Iranians were ready to limit their nuclear uranium enrichment to, I think, something like 0.67%. Not even 3.7. And so if Iranians were ready to do that in order to, you know, in order to have peace and to lift sanctions, then how did we even end up in all these problems? So somebody has used heavy-handed deception in order to mount this regime change initiative against Iran. And I think that, again, we have to place the United Kingdom at the very top of the list of suspects. Because, you know, we talked about this before, but in 2019, it was the British who tried very hard to persuade Donald Trump into launching an attack against Iran. So, you know, it was after the downing of the Reaper, I think, one of those big drones that the Americans fly over the Straits of Hormuz. The Iranians downed it, and then, you know, there was this big lobbying effort to try to persuade Trump into starting a war basically against Iran, and he said no. And then there was this this hysterical exchange of messages between the British embassy and the Foreign Office, berating Trump, criticizing him, calling him names because he refused to start war against Iran. But it was the British who wanted that war to happen and who mounted this whole diplomatic front against Trump to persuade him to do it. So it's been them all along, nonstop, always mixed in, but always acting behind the scene because they want the Americans to do the dirty work. And then when the Americans do the dirty work, then British often emerge and they pretend to be very critical of the Americans because of, you know, the use of force, and they shouldn't do this, and it's terrible and it's ugly, but we're here to help things and we're going to bring peace and stability and we're going to lead the negotiations. By the way, we're going to take it upon ourselves. We're going to negotiate some kind of a peaceful settlement because, you know, we're all about diplomacy and sitting at the table and talk. But it's always the same instigator. And, you know, before when you asked me the question of their cooperation with Qatar, you know, because Qatar, thanks to, you know, their relationship with the British, has been one of the, or if not the main financier to all these jihadi groups like Al-Qaeda and Al-Nusra and Khorasan and all of these splinter groups that emerged in the Middle East of these of these violent extremist jihadi fanatics. And so there's a person, there's a researcher called Karine Gevorgyan, and she's an expert orientalist, right? And here's a direct quote from her. Britain is trying to take the helm of world domination from the United States. One of their tools is control of virtually all radical Islamist movements in the world. So, you know, it's not just me saying it. It's, you know, if you scratch below the surface and you really look into what's going on and who's stirring the pot in the region, you always come up with the British.
Alex, how do you see the level of cooperation between Iran, Russia, and China in the aftermath of two attacks, one on Russia, which we know, in my opinion, was a British mission on Russian soil on nuclear bombers done by Ukrainians, and the other one, Israelis, maybe behind the scene British were supporting them. We don't know that. But how has these two attacks on Russia and Iran has changed the internal dynamic of the relationship between Iran, Russia, and China? It seems that I would argue on the part of Iran, they're much closer to Russia and China than before. Your take on what's going on in terms of their military, the security of the region, which is so much important when it comes to China, when it comes to Russia, as you mentioned, with these jihadists from Syria going to even Turkmenistan, I would argue. And how do you see what's going on between the three important countries?
I think it has only catalyzed a closer cooperation and a closer alliance between the three, because they very heavily depend one on another. You know, so Russia, if there was a regime change in Iran, and if the West managed to impose the Shah, and the Shah then realigned Iran with Israel, with the West, that would be the end of the international North-South transport corridor, which is very strategically important for Russia. And it's also an integral part of the Belt and Road Initiative. So it's also in that sense extremely important to China. And it also connects India to the northwest, to the northeast of Europe and the northwest of of Russia. And so for everybody but the Western Empire, this is very important. Now, whoever understands this understands it. They don't need additional evidence in the form of Israeli bombs and American bombs. But you know, you always have a segment, a part of the political class, who would like to realign the nation with the West nonetheless, because you know they'd like to send their children to Oxford and to Harvard, and they maybe have bank accounts in the West, and they would like to buy a house in London or already have it, or they're connected with the MEK somehow. And they can always argue, well, you know, if we aligned with the West, then, you know, they will lift sanction and we could develop our economy and we could be at peace and blah, blah, blah. And then, you know, like when these bombs fall, then, you know, you understand that making friendly overtures to the West is very foolish. They will stab you in the back all the same, even if you give them all the concessions. Because when you make all the concessions that they ask for, then they're going to say like, okay, hold on 1 minute, let's see about that. And then they're going to come with more demands. They're not going to say like, well, you know, if you agreed to all this, then we're best friends forever. We can lift all the sanctions. We can be friends and allies. We're going to be investing in your country. You're going to be getting all kinds of capital for development. And so on. It never happens that way. They always come back with more demands. And they've done whatever crisis you analyze through history, it's always the same. You know, 1938, the Sudeten, the crisis between Germany and Czechoslovakia over the Sudeten region in the west of Czechoslovakia, it was the same. They, you know, the Chamberlain government pressured Hitler into making all these extreme demands on the Edvard Beneš government in Prague. And then they pressured Beneš in Prague to concede everything. And then he says, okay, we don't want war. We concede everything. Then they go to Hitler and they say, we got all the concessions, but don't accept. You ask them this and this and this. You know, like, and then they pile in thing that they know is unacceptable to the other side. Because once you've weakened them to the maximum, then you still want to regime change. You still want to go to war. And this is always the same exact template. Now, you know, one thing, if you understand where the fault lines are, how they're laid out, and what the war is actually about. And I always go back to the, you know, that same George Soros thing. It's about, it's a war between two systems of governance. You understand that the war is existential for Russia, but it's also existential for Iran and for China, because if the West managed to regime change Russia, then in the very same way that they have used Ukraine as a proxy against Russia, then they would weaponize Russia as a proxy against China. And so once you understand that, then you know that their mutual support is not transactional, that you cannot bribe the Chinese away from supporting Russia, and you cannot bribe the Russians out of supporting Iran and China. And so this is, you know, we got proof of that, because last week the Chinese said there is no way that they will cease supporting Russia in their effort in Ukraine. And this is the reason, because it really is existential, and this really is the war for humanity between, you know, the Western Empire, which is the, you know, whatever reincarnation of the British Empire that we're looking at, and pretty much the whole rest of humanity, and that includes us in the West. Because, you know, if they manage to reach their goal of global domination, let's say they eliminated all the rivals, they eliminated, you know, their regime changed Russia, their regime changed Iran, their regime changed China, well, then their next target would be us. And they already told us what they think. They think we should be hackable animals, that we should be their worker ants. The war on farmers, the elimination of natural foods in favor of crickets and grasshoppers and stuff and so forth. This is who we're dealing with. And this is who Russia, China, and Iran are opposed to. And I increasingly believe that Trump is also opposed to them, that he is not a, let's say, a co-opted, sold-out ally of this center of power, but that he's actually the enemy to them.
What was the outcome of the meeting between Donald Trump and the NATO Secretary General Rutte? He said that Donald Trump was saying that these are wealthy European countries, talking about, I believe, Germany, United Kingdom, and France. They want to buy weapons to send them, I don't know, whatever. He's receiving the money. Let's assume, Alex, this, that Donald Trump is turning the situation in Ukraine in some sort of business, and the way that he's dealing with Europeans. But he's receiving the money. Nobody knows when he's going to deliver the weapons, because the American military industrial complex is not that much capable. I talked with Larry Johnson. He mentioned the limits of military industrial complex of the United States. They're not getting these weapons soon. But Donald Trump is receiving the money, and he doesn't care about Europeans. But after all, do you feel that Europeans know somehow, they're aware of what's going on, or they're trying to do whatever it takes to drag this war on and on to make, I don't know, in the aftermath of the Trump's presidency in the United States, they can continue the war against Russia, even in those days. Do they have any sort of long-term strategy? That's why they're doing this. They're trying to sacrifice everything in that to achieve that goal. That's why they're doing this.
Well, they are desperate to continue the war in Ukraine. They're absolutely desperate to continue that war. And so, you know, there, as you know, Friedrich Merz gave a speech this week in which he, you know, sent a message to the Russians and sent a message to Donald Trump. And the message to the Russian was, we will not give up. So, you know, business as usual, we definitely want this war to continue. We definitely, there are still some Ukrainians that can be sacrificed. And until we run out of Ukrainians, we want the war to go on. And they want to deliver them the Taurus missiles to strike against Russia and so forth. So they're all in, and they're not giving up. And I think that Merz is speaking on behalf of the European money lending oligarchies. You know, he doesn't speak for the German people. He's speaking for the same people that manage Emmanuel. You know, that are the patrons to Emmanuel Macron and Keir Starmer and Mark Rutte. So, but the second message from Friedrich Merz is to Donald Trump, stay with us, you know, stay with us, the Europeans, blah, 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 you know, so he's trying to, you know, make it look like we are the cool kids club, you know. And so, you know, they are very desperate to bring the United States back into the fold and for the United States to pay for the war and to supply weapons for the war and preferably to supply troops as well for the war. And because this has been, you know, this has been the role of the United States in the whole post-World War II order, you know, to wage wars on behalf of the Western Empire, pay for it, arm them, and provide troops. And this is what the United States has been doing. And I think that Trump is tired of that relationship. So I didn't really get to the bottom of what the deal is with the weapons, but it seems to me that Trump said, okay, we're going to supply all these weapons for the United States. But it's not like before under Biden, where they just ship the weapons to the Ukrainians and that's done. Now Trump wants the Ukrainians to pay for these weapons. And the Europeans, I mean, he wants Ukrainians to buy the weapons so they're not being gifted. And Ukrainians are going to pay for it the Ukrainians are going to buy the weapons, but the Europeans are going to pay for them. And I think that the terms that he imposed on these transfers are such that I think there's already about 10 NATO members countries who said, like, we're not interested, we're not doing this, we're not paying for these weapons. So it seems to me that the whole Trump pivot wasn't really a pivot against Russia and in favor of the Ukrainians, that the pivot was, okay, you are desperate to continue this war, fine. You're going to have to pay for it now. So I'll deliver the weapons to your Volodymyr Zelensky, but it's going to come at a cost that you're going to pay with your money, and we are going to deliver them when we can and when we have them. So it was like a very, very crappy deal for the Europeans and for Ukraine, but it did allow the public relations side of things to, you know, turning into some kind of a victory of Trump turning against Putin, and Trump, you know, like the Financial Times ran a story in which they kind of deviously slipped in that Trump was encouraging Volodymyr Zelensky to strike at Moscow and at St. Petersburg, which the White House denied. And Trump himself said, no, I don't think he should be striking at Moscow at all. And then the BBC also tried to slip in this this leak that Trump said something like that he's done with Vladimir Putin, then, you know, no more Mr. Nice Guy. And then Trump denied that. Well, you know, this is all psyops to try to derail the relationship between the United States and Russia, and to try to, you know, force Trump back into the fold of the Western powers, ultimately with a goal of maneuvering him into providing a security guarantee to the Kiev government, which I don't think is going to happen, because again, it seems to me that Trump understands the game, and that he is, you know, whether he's being stupid or you know, stupid like a fox, or I think that he's stirring the ship in the right direction. And, you know, there was also a speech by Tulsi Gabbard recently in which she said that there are very, very strong pressures being exerted on the administration every single day to derail the relationship between the United States and Russia, and to bring back the United States into the fold of the Western colonial powers.
I think that the way that Tulsi Gabbard was talking about, every day they're fighting the establishment in the United States.
Yeah, yeah.
And when we put ourselves in the shoes of Russians and looking at the United States and the way that Donald Trump somehow, I would argue, he didn't do that much in terms of what's going on in Ukraine, Alex. Russia wanted something more. Russia wanted to put an end to the conflict by negotiations, diplomacy. But it doesn't seem that would be the case on the part of the establishment in the United States. They're so powerful, Alex. They're so much powerful. They're in each and every institutions. Each and every institution in the United States, the government, the think tanks, all of these together. It's a huge network. But when it comes to the Russian strategy, do you think they're getting to the point that, so Donald Trump is trying to do whatever he's trying to do in the United States? We don't know the exact reality of what's going on there, but we have our part of reality. We know our capabilities. We know how to deal with Europe to deal with Ukraine as a proxy, as a proxy of Europe or United Kingdom. Do you feel that Russia is getting to that point to decide about everything on the battlefield?
Well, you know, I think that's an interesting question, and this is why I'm not even convinced that the Russians want to end the war at the negotiating table. It seems to me that the Russians are consistently offering negotiations in good faith because, you know, if you offer a deal at a negotiating table, even if it's a very, very tough deal, you come there with ready to negotiate, ready to sign a peace agreement, an armistice, but, you know, you set your conditions. If you do that and the other side says, no, we will not accept these terms, then you are justified in continuing the war. You know, like, you have a moral and also a legal justification for continuing to pursue your ends through military means, because the other side rejected the diplomatic means. So I think that, you know, the Russians have done that since the very beginning of the war. On the fourth day of the special military operations, the Russians already reached out to Kiev to offer a negotiated settlement. And at that stage, they were only asking to keep Crimea. They were not asking for the Donbas at all. So, you know, except for Crimea, Ukraine would have remained, their territorial integrity would have remained unchallenged. Of course, then we know that Boris Johnson flew over to Kiev and said, like, no, don't negotiate any peace. We're behind you. You're going to win this. We're going to take down Russia. Fight it out on the battlefield. And then, you know, we see where we are now. But I believe that this is simply the Russian approach to waging war, because they have to be able to show the international community, their own people, and the Ukrainians that they have done everything to avoid the war and to limit the damage from the conflict. Because, you know, after the war, there's going to have to be a political solution to the conflict. And the Ukrainian people will be keen to understand the history of how that war happened. And in order for them to become again in the future a friendly neighboring nation, they have to see that the Russians didn't come to slaughter civilian population for no good reason, just out of like a bloodthirsty revenge, but that they tried everything to find a political solution and limit the damage and the destruction and the casualties. So this is where I think the Russian inclination to always come to the negotiating table comes from. On the other side of the Atlantic, the United States, I think that they understand. I know that they understand. I mean, there's been enough statements to that effect that the people in the Trump administration know fully well that the war in Ukraine is over for all practical purposes and that the Ukrainians lost. So that's a lost cause. No need to throw more resources into trying to reverse something that's already, you know, finished. So I think that from Trump's point of view is, you know, he's also getting these pressures at home to support Ukraine, to turn hostile against Russia, to impose bone-crushing sanctions and so forth. And so, you know, rather than taking these pressures head on and to say like, no, I will not do that, I will start nice and friendly relationship with Russia, he basically turns around and says like, fine, okay, Europeans want to go to war, they want to wage war against Russia still in Ukraine, fine, we'll provide them weapons, but you have to pay for them. And so he turns it into a business deal that's very favorable to the United States and very unfavorable to the Europeans. So he's, in a way, you know, he's helping to financially weaken Europe. And so if they want to do that, fine, here you go. You know, you give them the rope that they need to hang themselves with, and that's what they're going to end up doing in the end.
But it doesn't seem that they have the French money, the French budget behind the deal between the Europeans. And it seems that it's all about Germany and United Kingdom.
Yes, in fact, I think it's all going to unravel because I don't think that Hungary is on board. Italy is not on board. Slovakia is not on board. I don't think even Poland is on board. So I think it's the whole thing is going to be unraveling. You know, I don't even understand whether this needs to be unanimous or not at the NATO level. But I don't think it's going to work out at all. So the support that Trump gave them came at such unfavorable terms that it's going to end up being very, very unattractive. And some of them are moaning about the 50-day time limit, you know, where he said, oh, I'm going to impose all these costs on Russia if they don't come to the table within 50 days. I don't know how he came up with that 50 days number, but I wouldn't be surprised if it wasn't reached in some kind of a back channel communication with the Russians themselves. And we can see that the Russians have now sharply increased the intensity of their attacks on Ukraine. So maybe there will be an offensive towards the end of the summer where they will just sweep to who knows where, maybe to the east bank of the Dnieper River. We'll find out. But you know, something is coming up, and it has panicked the West enough that the British are now, I think they're already doing it, they're trying to transfer a nuclear weapon to the Ukrainians. So this is the big danger, you know. And you know, there was recently the Odessa Security Forum held in Odessa, and there was a British general there. Maybe he wasn't a general, maybe Lieutenant Colonel, forget his name. But he was saying, yes, I think that the United Kingdom should help Ukraine obtain a nuclear weapon. He wasn't just thinking about that. They're already doing it. And this is the big danger, because you know, as this admiral in Croatia that I like to listen to, he said that they will do everything to get somebody to detonate a nuclear weapon, whether it's Iran or Pakistan or Israel or Ukraine is secondary, but they want to cause chaos because to them they are in such desperate straits that they only see the possibility of reversing their fortune if there's a nuclear exchange, and then they can save their system and emerge as peacemakers. And I would like to remind everybody that last September, all of the webcams in the city of London went dark, and they're still dark to this day. Not all of them, sorry. There's one or two that are still working. You know, the readers alerted me. There's one on that famous street where the Beatles took a picture walking across. Yeah. I forget now. That one is working, and maybe another one. But all of the other ones are dark. And why should all the webcams in the city of London go dark all of a sudden, all at once? Somebody made that decision. That's not a random occurrence. Somebody made the decision and switched them off for some reason. And my first suspicion was they're planning a false flag attack.
It's called Abbey Road.
Yeah, correct. The Abbey Road. Yeah. The one on Abbey Road apparently works, but maybe nothing very important is happening on Abbey Road other than tourists taking pictures crossing that street. But elsewhere, you know, there might be moving things around. There might be keen for there not to be any video footage of events, because they're preparing something and they're desperate enough to be offering a nuclear weapon to the most corrupt regime in the world, which is at war. I mean, this is reckless beyond belief, but they're saying that they want to do it and they're doing it.
Alex, the way that Russia was trying to negotiate with the West, it was about the eastern part of Ukraine, even talking about Donbass. And as time went by, we see that Russia is changing its strategy, its goals. And do you feel that with what's going on with the British intelligence, we know that how they're involved with the Zelensky administration, do you feel that Russia would let Odessa in the hands of Ukrainians after all?
No, there's no way. There's no way that they will leave Odessa in the hands of Ukrainians. And I have to qualify this, you know, because it's not 100% certain that the Russians are going to liberate Odessa by military means, because I don't think that they have to. What Russia has to achieve is for the government in Kiev to realign with Moscow. That's what they need to achieve. If that happens, then there's no need to militarily liberate Odessa, because for all practical purposes, at that point, Russia already controls Odessa. So I think that's going to be the battle, you know, the battle for the transition of Ukrainian government, so that from a Western aligned government, it becomes a Moscow aligned government. And so I think that this is going to be part of the peace negotiations, part of the armistice. And so long as the Ukrainians are refusing and will continue to be supported by the West and be aligned with the West, then, you know, maybe if the Ukrainian defenses grow so weak that it becomes easy for the Russians to take Odessa without, you know, destroying the city itself, then they might try to take it over militarily or to surround it and blockade it and force the, you know, force the other side to lay down their arms. But I think that the cheaper and easier and more elegant way of taking control would be in an administrative process, and all they need is a regime change in Kiev.
Yeah. Alex, I don't know if you saw the video of the interview of Ford Motors CEO, he's talking about the competition between the United States and China in terms of the car production. And here is what he said, Alex. I think after all, we talk about the Middle East, about Russia, Ukraine, but the bigger picture is the fight between the competition between the United States and China. And here is what he said. I think it's so important to be considered in the bigger picture of what's going on.
I've ever seen 70% of all EVs in the world, electric vehicles, are made in China. They have far superior in-vehicle technology. Huawei and Xiaomi are in every car. They have facial
recognition.
Meaning
cell phone technology.
Yes, yes.
Connected to their cell phones.
Yes, you get in, you don't have to pair your phone. Automatically, your whole digital life is mirrored in the car. You have an AI companion that you can talk to, ChatGPT equivalent in China. All the automatic payment is already there. You can buy movie tickets. It has facial recognition, so it knows who's in which seat and which media you like.
Wait, why don't Ford cars have that? Would you need to do it with Apple or?
Yeah, because Google and Apple decided not to go in the car business. And even beyond that, their cost, their quality of their vehicles is far superior to what I see in the West. I mean, we are in a global competition with China, and it's not just EVs. And if we lose this, we do not have a future Ford.
Yeah, it's the picture that he's drawing for us is somehow frightening, and what's going on. And your take on that, on the way that the United States, do you think that the United States under the Trump administration understands what's going on?
Oh, yeah, absolutely they do. I mean, you know, the Chinese can now, they build nuclear power plants where the cost of electricity per megawatt hour is something like 20% of what it costs if you go with an American nuclear power plant. There's an Australian institution that tracks technology development around the world and ranks countries in terms of how advanced they are. You know, they look at the number of articles published in peer-reviewed press, the number of patents applied to the market share for various technologies, so forth. A very comprehensive review. And so what they found that about 20 years ago, the United States was the leading technology, was leading in, I think, something like 60 out of 67 technologies. Fields of technology around the world, and today that practically inverted, where China is the world leader in 60 out of 67. Like I'm not telling you the exact number, but it's pretty much that. And I think that's normal because, you know, the Chinese have deliberately made efforts to, you know, to mobilize a whole society approach to technology development, to industrialization. So it's, you know, like the universities are involved, the state is involved, the private enterprise is involved. They made it easier for people to set up and finance businesses, to develop them, to bring them to market, to source know-how from universities and to hire new engineers. They subsidize universities to form technological and engineering IT talent, and they made it easy for even foreign countries and foreign companies to set up R&D centers in China. So, you know, if you make it easy and cheap for me to develop, conduct research and development in China, then I might do that. And then, you know, what China gets out of it, that you bring some of the top brains from the West into China, where they then can work with them and they can even poach them. They can tell them, like, hey, if you come to work for Xiaomi, then you're going to get a better salary, bigger bonus, whatever. And so they've been able to poach top talent from Western corporations and Western nations to their own side. And at the same time, you know, the West has been mired in spending substantially all of their money on wars and bombs and missiles and military aircraft and military bases everywhere around the world. So obviously, you know, China is going to be running circles. I think this is crystal clear to Trump and to the people around him. You know, people who get it are like people like J.D. Vance and Scott Bessent and Peter Navarro. And they are dead serious about turning the ship around and starting to catch up with China. And this is part of the big, beautiful bill that many people don't understand because they're just focused on this, you know, fiscal, how do you call it, fiscal conservatism angle. And they think that all the spending is just to, you know, give a lot of money to Trump's friends and cronies. No, it's to facilitate something similar to FDR's New Deal, to bring the United States back into being an industrial powerhouse, a research and development powerhouse, and to foster new innovation and research and development so that the United States can catch up and compete against China and other nations. Because, you know, it's not just that. Iran is producing a lot of engineering talent and new scientific and technological advances. And so are the Russians. And so are the Indians. So it's no longer where, you know, the West has the primacy and monopoly on advanced technology and everybody else is just kind of exporting raw materials and living in poverty, having to buy technologies from the West. So the world has changed, and there's absolutely no doubt that Trump and his people in his administration perfectly understand this.
And Alex, here in Brazil, in the state of Bahia, we call it Bahia, and he, BYD replaced Ford company, and they just, you look at the area they're occupying right now, it's 10 times the area that Ford was there. They took all that area, they just expanded the area that they're building huge, huge car production here in Brazil. And
amazing.
It's unbelievable. Look at I later on you can look at it on Google. You see the area they're occupying, the production. It's a city, really. Yeah. It's a city. They're building a city here in Brazil. And on the road, whenever I go between the cities here in Brazil, you see the BYD cars is all on the road going to these various cities.
I start to see them in Europe as well, which is just incredible. And they look nice enough, but you know, my understanding is the Chinese have really advanced the battery technology to the extent that even somebody like me, who is, I'm the farthest away you can get from a EV enthusiast, you know. But you know, if you have a battery that runs for 2,000 or 3,000 cycles, which can charge in 5 minutes and which has a autonomy of 1,000 kilometers, well, you know, even I start to think like, that's interesting. You know, if they resolve the electromagnetic radiation inside the car, I might even get interested in an electric car at that stage.
Thank you so much, Alex, for being with us today.
Great pleasure, as always, Nima. And until the next time.
Yeah, see you soon.
Take care. Bye-bye. Bye.